702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Well, the ANC's National Executive Committee met at NASREC today and then stopped meeting and said, you know what, we'll meet again, the National Working Committee, the NWC, because this is too much for the NEC. The NWC must ASAP have a look at the PP report. So, anyway, Sam Nkokeli is the Business Day and Financial Mail magazine columnist. And Sam, give me some detail, as much granular detail as you can, as to what went down at NASREC today as the NEC met to decide how they were going to play the problem that is Cyril Ramaphosa.
A lovely introduction there. Also love the pace at which you narrated it. It's a yo-yo, you know, Cyril wants to resign. His friends and colleagues is resigning, and they come on to 702 and say, hey, please don't resign. And then the NEC is supposed to meet. Somebody says, no, Mr. President, you can't resign before you've told the NEC. The NEC must meet. The president doesn't want to attend the NEC or he wants to attend the NEC. And then somebody says, no, let's do the officials meeting, the top six meeting first, before anything gets done. You kick the NEC back to Sunday, and then the rest of the country is watching this yo-yo that keeps going down, up and down, up and down. But the biggest issue here is you've got a president who doesn't want the job. He's been showing it in the past 4 years that he doesn't want the job based on his a poor performance and the lack of his struggle to taking decisions. Now he has to take a decision of a lifetime. He can't even take that one. He's resigning, not resigning.
Okay, I mean, let's be fair about this one, Sam. I mean, all of the indications are that yesterday, this time, he was willing to resign, yet he's had his arm twisted by members of his party, people who are loyal to him and people upon whose careers, I mean, his career, their career depends on his career in politics. They don't have 20 billion options to retire to. He does, so he'd quite happily walk away. Yet he's had his arm twisted not to. Is that him not making a decision, or is that him saying, "Okay, let's see how the let's see how the cards land on this one"?
No, it's not him taking a decision. Look, if he is taking a decision to resign on principle, no amount of twisting his rubber arm should change that. If it doesn't matter of principle, it's the nature of the man who struggles taking decisions. And it's a very tough time. And the people around him depend on him for their future. Gwede Mantashe. Gwede Mantashe is not one of the people who are likely to make the top six. Now, he needs to get into the top six. Beautiful opportunity. Beautiful, good politician. This is an opportunity. He runs with it. And so do the others. Cabinet ministers, they don't want to see him go because they would lose those comfortable jobs. And now they have him as their hostage. He's stuck and keeps going around, and he wants to go. And with that, as a politician, you're demonstrating vulnerability. You never come back from that state.
How, I mean, is there any indication as to how the ANC may deal with the problem of the vacuum that Cyril Ramaphosa would leave on the ballot paper for the leadership of the party come the 16th, 17th, 18th of December?
No, there is no indication at all. I mean, the Ramaphosa camp is at a stage of shock. Then the next stage will be denial, and that they go through all the stages of grief. And they like it to say, okay, let's go the lawfare route. The report is flawed, and now let's take that route. But morally, I mean, the explanation coming out of the president's affidavit around this, I mean, he's taken quite a knock. And with his credibility. But the ANC is not even looking at that. Also, he may survive now, but in a couple of months' time, he's got a problem. We still want to know what happened to the forex investigation and what the Reserve Bank's take is on the matter. We might get more information around this money. I mean, we're still not getting enough of the president's side of the story, and the explanations are really, really weak, and it's really just a dodgy story. So the ANC has a political problem. He's now playing around factional battle and pseudo-legal analysis and also really silly the moral equivalence between Zuma stealing public money and Ramaphosa stealing his own money. I mean, it's not a question of whether or not he stole his own money. There's a lot around it about his job, moral leadership, and also the oath of office. I mean, those are the issues. So the ANC is behaving like it behaved around 2016 with Jacob Zuma and just before that. With the entanglement. this thing is written out there, it's on the writing is on the wall, the ANC is going to have a crash with Cyril Ramaphosa, and its electability in 2024 is going to fall within probably in the 30s the way it's behaving now. And I'm sure Peter Altman-Tato is going to explain this thing just now. What's happened is volatility and the markets over the next couple of weeks, which is a yo-yo, political yo-yo, that we are just seeing here the unraveling of the ANC and its inability to manage complex situations. It is so ordinary, just thinking in basic numbers, in faction terms.
Yeah, it's an astonishing catastrophe for a party that should be far more adept at dealing with these conundrums that it faces on a fairly regular basis, frankly. And when we look at Tuesday and the National Assembly and Parliament to debate the issue of the Palapala report, does Cyril Ramaphosa get as far as Tuesday, do you think? Does he get even that far, or is he gone by Tuesday? What's your reading of it?
Look, he wants to go. He wants to go now. Does he want to face Parliament? He can't go to Parliament without being heckled. He can't stand anywhere without looking dodgy. He wants to go as soon as possible. The section will look around and say, okay, do we have the numbers? We need a simple majority of 50 plus 1 to fight this thing so that it doesn't go to the whole process where he could be impeached. That's what those are the calculations they have to make. Also, in terms of the numbers, I mean, half that caucus comes from is Mahashule's RAT people. So anything is possible. He will not want to take the gamble. But his faction wants the gamble because they depend on him. They are riding him. It's like riding an alligator or crocodile across the river. That is what they're doing to Cyril Ramaphosa. They will dump him at some stage, but right now they're holding him for dear life on his tail as a crocodile that drags them through the water.
Is there anybody who looks like they're putting up their hand tentatively to say, Tumamina, send me? Other than Paul Mashatile, potentially, who seems fairly popular within the ANC to stand against William Kize. Anybody else?
Look, a knockout between the two of those guys is problematic. Anybody else? I don't know. Khalima Mosande is not interested. But we have 14 days to go to for the ANC conference. That feels like 14 years or longer. A lot of things are going to happen in the next couple of days. Otlanta might have to reconsider. They might look around. But whatever they do, they are rapidly moving into a position where that they are not the central point of our politics. In one catastrophe with Ramaphosa and how they are responding to it already.
Thank you to Sam Umkokeri, who is the Business Day and Financial Mail columnist on The Money Show this evening.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702. 702.
Our Friday file this evening, Peter Attard-Montalto. He is a capital markets analyst at Intellidex. He's the head of capital markets research at Intellidex. Political uncertainty. Why do the trials and tribulations of individuals and individuals within political parties have such a dramatic impact on markets? Please, we'll explain that with Peter Attard-Montalto in just a bit. But first, let's talk to Peter Doyle. Noel Doyle, I beg your pardon, is the chief executive of Tiger Brands. It makes Albany Bread, it makes Beacon Chocolates, it makes Oros and a whole lot more. It's upped its dividend by 29%. It's got a nice big boost in profits up to nearly 3 billion rand. Noel Doyle, how do you as a chief executive, when all of the trials and tribulations and difficulties and woes of a political party cause absolute havoc in capital markets, how do you cope on a Tiger Brands basis? What do you react at all? Do you send out memos internally? Do you, like the rest of us, hide under your desk?
Well, we don't have the luxury, I'm afraid, of hiding under the desk. We have to deal with these things on a day-to-day basis. Look, I think, Bruce, we just try and respond as calmly and reflectively as possible. You know, we look when the exchange rate, you know, wobbles all over the place. We try and take advantage of that from an export proceeds perspective. And we try and predict, you know, the length and extent of the volatility and react to that accordingly. But for the most part, we just keep our eye on the prize. We keep our eye on when we come out of the tunnel. And while we're in the tunnel, you know, we scrap for every cent we can make in turnover, for every inch of shelf space, for every second of the consumer's attention, and try and stay focused on that, because there are certain things that we can control, and those things we really can't. We just adapt our plans but without knee jerking.
But I mean, I think 2022 has been probably the year of most unpredictable activities in swift succession and sometimes overlapping in 2022. COVID sort of seemed to be passing, and we had the invasion of one of the biggest grain producing areas of the world in Ukraine. We've seen an energy crisis in Europe courtesy of sanctions against Russia. We've seen a spike up in food inflation. I mean, in South Africa, food inflation is sitting at 12%, and that's all well and good in the short term. It allows you to drive up revenues. It allows you to perhaps expand margins just a little bit. But at some point, food becomes less affordable and people stop buying your brands. That's got to be a concern to you.
Bruce, that's a huge concern in the short term. And I mean, we've already felt it this year. If you look, volume in both halves of this year, down 1%. And you can see consumers migrating to value. We operate in the premium end of the market. And even in our portfolio, there's very much a consumer bias and a shopper bias now, picked up even in the activities over last weekend, the Black Friday weekend, where consumers are moving towards basic commodities. They're shopping less frequently. They are shopping less categories. You know, areas of our portfolio like personal care and home care. You know, people are taking the newspaper instead of Doom to deal with the insects. You know, some people are coming to work without spraying our beautiful status deodorant on them. that's real. You know, those categories are contracting because they really need to, you know, that cliche, put food on the table. And it's a trend towards basic food. So we have to work really hard, you know, on margin management within the business. We have to avoid the temptation of taking very short-term decisions. So we're investing in South Africa and in our business for the future. And in the meantime, trying to walk that tightrope. And it's been a challenge for the last couple of years with all that's kind of befallen the global and the South African economy. Walk that tightrope of producing a set of numbers that are, you know, reasonably acceptable to our shareholders and other stakeholders, and at the same time, you know, building for the future and catching up with some of the deficits Tiger has had. You know, our underspend on IT is something that we've been correcting over the last couple of years. So we need, you know, an ex-colleague of mine used to use a phrase, steady hand at the tiller. That's what required. And then an incredible amount of aggression and agility to make every single possible sale in every single possible outlet that you can. We really have to be, again, I'll quote from one of my current colleagues, you know, one eye on the microscope, one eye on the telescope. and it can leave you a bit squint-eyed at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Make you, I don't know if it's very good to give you perspective. It might make your eyes a bit squonk, but I do understand the principle of what they're talking about. Do you see any respite coming? I mean, is there anywhere where you're beginning to see, hold on a second, there's a bit of inflation mitigation here, people are making up for the shortfalls out of Ukraine there. Is there any of that sort of activity happening at this stage?
I think we're starting to see some positive movement in most of the soft commodities. But I think the relief, you know, that people have taken positions, I don't think we'll see relief this side of Easter. The year-on-year inflation in food pricing, my view, is still going to stay very high for the next 3 or 4 months until the base effect kicks in. And, you know, most of the big price increases took place in the second half of 2022. And then I do think that there'll be a fairly significant reduction in the level of inflation in the second half of the year. But I'm not sure that is going to give us a huge amount of relief, because for middle-income consumers in particular, you know, these interest rate hikes have not yet fully been felt in the household budgets. And I think that that's going to be a drag that will probably more than offset the benefits of lower or even deflation potentially in one or two categories in the second half of next year. So our prediction is it's going to be a really, really tight volume environment. You know, most wage settlements in the private sector are between 5% and 7%. And for most of those employees, if you look at their own internal basket, you know, our calculations would show that you have a basket that's going up between 17 and 20%. You know, when you take the effect of transport and food as big components of an average person's basket.
Thank you to Noel Doyle this evening. Noel is the chief executive of South Africa's biggest food producer, and that, of course, is Tiger Brands. News on another food producer today and a delay to their listing. Brait deciding it won't be listing Premier because of all the political uncertainty and all of the chaos around us. We'll pick up on that story in a moment. The US adding also 263,000 jobs in November. It's well above expectations. We saw the unemployment rate in the US remain unchanged at 3.7%. Wage growth in the US now is sitting at about 5%. Very strong US labor market. And as Kevin Lings put it on social media earlier, saying it's bad for markets because what it does do is signals sustained interest rate hikes. Certainly Jerome Powell this week, he indicated that interest rates would go up in December, but only by 50 basis points, not 75 as previously. And that pushed the dollar quite a bit weaker. Not that we noticed because of our national sport of shooting ourselves in the foot, of course, when it comes to our local politics.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
It's been a heck of a week, Patrick Matidi, the head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. Have you aged?
Good evening, Bruce, and a good evening to your listeners. Absolutely, I do feel I have lost, you know, a few of my useful lives that are still remaining. It was indeed a very, very volatile. I guess, you know, we did see the risks, but as often, you know, when the, you know, the tire hits the tarmac, you know, that's when reality hits. And I think what we saw yesterday was indeed that reality that, you know, we may have, you know, a risk, you know, in our midst here in the form of a vacuum when it comes to the leadership in the country.
Yeah, I mean, again, and it's almost like South Africa is almost on some sort of global watch list of negativity. The moment any bad news happens, there is a disproportionate response. Some, maybe, you know, we saw it happen in the UK earlier this year, of course. The UK, when it came out with crackpot economics as an idea as to how to grow the economy, markets were very quick and very brutal as well. And, you know, we haven't been as proactive in dealing with our issues domestically, but this isn't necessarily something that just affects South Africa. The politics of crazy at the upper ends of the political elites and echelons do unfortunately have economic consequences and knock-ons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're sort of living in an integrated world where, you know, financial markets are linked to the real economy and are linked to policy, which ultimately is driven by the, you know, the those in government. So anything there that presents any uncertainty from a policy point of view, from a continuity point of view, you know, you tend to see that getting reflected almost immediately in financial market reactions.
Okay, so talk to me, please, about the decision by Premier Foods. Now, Premier is owned, of course, by Brait, and Brait was planning to list Premier Foods on the Premier on the JSE later on this month, and they've withdrawn it. I mean, just, you know, yesterday's volatility in the markets was enough to scare the living donuts out of them.
Yeah, it would appear so. I mean, we woke up to that announcement. You know, they had been doing the rounds, meeting investors and presenting their story and the rationale for listing. So, you know, it's a bit of a good story. If you look at, you know, the business and the profile in terms of the assets that they hold, obviously that's going to depend on the pricing ultimately. But I guess, you know, with the volatility that came through yesterday, you know, they said that, you know, they're not comfortable that, you know, the listing will be favorable, meaning that it's likely that people will shun it and just focus on negativity and therefore will not likely get the right value that they are seeking because they are looking to raise capital and pay off debt. So on the back of those concerns, they announced that they will be, you know, I guess, postponing, hopefully to a time and date when there is relative calm back in the market.
Yeah, it's so frustrating and so disappointing, isn't it? I mean, that the stupidity and the short-termness of politics gets in the way. But today's activity was quite interesting. The Rand recovered a little bit of yesterday's huge losses as the ANC decided not to go for a knee-jerk reaction. Sam Mkhukele is saying that Cyril wants to go and he's being held hostage by people with vested interests wanting to keep their jobs. Goodness knows what the truth is within the corridors of the ANC. But you almost wanted to get over and done with as quickly as possible, don't you, Patrick? I mean, just to let's get whatever the uncertainty is, let's make it certain.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you could see it in today's market reaction. So at an index level, you know, it does hide quite a few cracks. But as soon as you start to scratch through and actually peel and then go into some of the indices, you could see that in the financials that were lowered yesterday, about 9% on average, not fully recovering, only about 2% up today. And then on the resources side, and a bit of profit taking given yesterday's a rally. So the market is down about 1% this morning or today, compared to about 0.5% yesterday. But the uncertainty, I think, is still, you know, at the name of the game, where, you know, people are just saying, look, you know, whatever the case is, let's see who else comes in, and then hopefully, you know, see if there's any continuity in terms of what the current president stands for, and hopefully, you know, restore some certainty back into financial markets.
It was interesting today to see Enoch Godongwana talking and saying, you know, there's a 10% chance of Cyril Ramaphosa going, and even if he does go, it's going to have no impact on economic policy. That's probably wishful thinking, isn't it? Because, I mean, yes, the ANC at its economic policy conferences determine policy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, leadership from the top certainly has a direct impact as to how and if policy is implemented, and if so, how.
And absolutely, absolutely. I think that that's the key issues that the markets are worried about. You know, whoever comes in, what will be the tone? And we kind of know the policies of the ANC, but the key issues always around implementation. So to what extent will they implement it, what pace, and all those kind of factors. And, you know, if as and when they implement, you know, the implication of the fiscals and affordability and all that goes with it. So I wouldn't say that, you know, it would be seamless. I think there will need to be some, recalibration back into what the markets have been used to. And to the extent that there are differences, which is most likely, then you should see that, you know, reflected in the share prices going forward.
Patrick Matidi, thank you. The head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the sole sustainability coordinators of SAPI's recent 2 billion rand, 5-year sustainability-linked revolving credit facility. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
On our Friday File, we're talking chocolate. We're going to play the Brutal Biz quiz and look forward to your participation in that this evening. And between 7 and 8, we've got some of the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. But first, let me tell you what's coming up on the next Money Show. The Discovery Bank Chief Executive, Hilton Kalner, every year identifies a dozen books. It becomes his festive season reading list, and he shares a dozen books with people he believes need to change their outlook on leadership, on management, on inspiration, on motivation. And he's going to share those, or some of those, with us on the next Money Show. We'll also get to the CEOs of Oceana and Nampak on the big money stories, and sadly, politics stories of the day too, at the moment.
The Money Show. The Friday File. The Friday File.
Richard Tomes is the lead chocolatier at Chocolate by Tomes. I think I speak for everybody, Richard, when I say, how does one become a chocolatier? Because I think that must be the dream job of dream jobs, at least for the first week.
Well, you can either just start your own, and as I did, and read a lot of books, do a lot of experiments, and come up with a range. Or I think you can train, actually, Belgium, or I think there's an online course as well. But I basically sat down and taught myself.
Are you sick of chocolate?
No, I love chocolate. Every day I have chocolate. Yes, it's very good.
You started this business in 2005. What are you doing before 2005, before you and Lorraine go decide to buy yourself a chocolate shop at the V&A Waterfront?
Oh, well, I was a lawyer in the city in London, and Lorraine was in HR again in London. And we basically decided that we wanted something more. So we, I think for about 3 years, we saved like crazy. And then moved over to South Africa. Lorraine is South African. And in that process, we obviously gave up our jobs. So we had to look for something else and spotted an advert for the chocolate shop at the V&A. So we decided to buy it.
Yeah, and I mean, was it when it's the fact that it was a chocolate shop, was that the deciding factor? Because did you change it much? You certainly brought your own branding and your own identity into it.
Yeah, originally it was importing chocolates from other chocolatiers, and we certainly continued along that route. But we decided that actually what we wanted to do was introduce our own brand, and the only way we thought we could do that properly was by manufacturing our own chocolates or range of chocolates. So we began by buying in the block chocolate and then melting that down, casting our own truffles and filling them with our centers. But ultimately that went on to become, we would make our own chocolate with a conscience that we have, so that everything was chocolates by Tomes. So the chocolate you're eating is chocolate that we actually made, as opposed to buying in and melting it down.
And that's, I mean, surely if you're going to do this yourself, that is the only way to do it. You need a real identity. If you're simply buying in Belgian chocolate from some Belgian chocolate mass producer, well, that's very nice. You can differentiate, I suppose, with the centers and with the blends and the flavors and the nuts that you put in. But really, how complicated was that process of learning the chocolate making? Because if it was easy, we'd all do it.
It's just a matter of reading a lot of books and understanding the chemistry behind making chocolate. Mm. So you're right, for us, the identity, the real ethos behind this was we saw all of the raw ingredients coming out of Africa, but they were being exported to Europe. And we thought to ourselves, well, this is crazy. Why are we not buying those ingredients and creating a uniquely African chocolate, which is what we were doing at the time, or what we did at the time. And so we made that decision. We said, okay, we'll now make a chocolate, but everything that we source will be from Africa. So the sugar is obviously South African. The cocoa ingredients are from West Africa. And we felt that by doing that, we created our own unique chocolate, which, as you say, is the aim of the game. Why are we buying in Belgium chocolate when we have this wonderful produce raw ingredients on our doorstep? We should be adding value here in Africa, not buying in chocolate from Europe, where the value has been added there. And that essentially was the philosophy behind why we decided to make the chocolate.
And how stable are your supply chains of raw ingredients? Because demand for your ingredients are stratospheric worldwide.
Yeah, we were lucky. We were partnered with a company called Carston Walker, and they regularly supplied, they supply food ingredients. And so the supply chain was very strong through them. If there were delays at ports, which was beyond their control, there were other suppliers that we would use. But by and large, Carston Walker were the suppliers that we used. They were our supplier of choice. And we have a very strong relationship with them. We always have over the last, 12, 15 years that we've been making chocolate. And they are very proficient at getting stock to us.
And just the dynamics of producing chocolate, I mean, how significant of a factory setup do you have nowadays? Do you sort of measure it in tons, in cubic meters? Yeah. What do you move?
We manufacture around 60 to 70 tons of chocolate a year. We have grown. When we first started, we were in a factory of about 120 square meters with 3 employees, and now we have 600-700 square meters with a factory complement of close on 30. So that's how we've grown it, and it's grown through customer engagement. So as our customer base has grown, we've also grown. We moved from the 150 square factory to a 300 square factory, and then rented the factory next door to us and broke through the walls. So that became the 600-700 square meters that we currently have. But we are going to have to move again pretty soon.
That's good news. I mean, it's a pain, but it's good news.
Yes.
What percentage of what you make is sold in South Africa? Because South Africa is, I think, would have a fairly small market for specialty chocolate. And as the Americans, as Mondelez, has added too much sugar to Cadbury's and has made that quite hard to swallow, we've seen Lindt grow in South Africa. So there's a luxury chocolate dominance of the global brands. How do you fit into that landscape?
We sell everything in South Africa. So all of our of the tonnage that we produce each year, is sold within South Africa. And I have to say, the only thing that has stopped us expanding for the time being is our ability to produce chocolate. We have reached a capacity ceiling. So and that's to the point where, you know, we aren't necessarily turning away people, but we're very aware that if we accept new clients in January, February, March, come December, that might be an issue. So we have to balance that very carefully, certainly during this year. So yeah, everything is sold in South Africa. We don't have any capacity to sell elsewhere for the moment. That will change though.
It's an astounding achievement, frankly. I mean, that's a lot of chocolate that you're moving on an annual basis. How do you do it? What are your main distribution channels that you use?
Well, we distribute ourselves. We obviously have the shop at the V&A, but the main focus is on the wholesale market, and that is into most of the top hotels, mainly in Cape Town, but beyond that, throughout South Africa. We supply a lot of other chocolatiers with our chocolate, so they in turn will cast their own truffles using our chocolate, as well as bakers, restaurants, etc.
There's a huge amount of expenditure that goes into brand development, into brand building, into brand positioning of chocolate. I mean, it's one of those categories, I think, that is very well represented. How do you chip away at that market and sort of try and drive a wedge into a very heavily traded sector and segment?
It's just consistency. You can't, as you say, you are just chipping away. There's a big chip that comes out, but most of the time you're just chipping away, and you slowly create your own little niche using the branding that you want to use, using your USP that you feel is appropriate to you. And it's a matter of just constantly reinforcing that message. Continuous marketing, social media. You can't take a break from that. You really can't. The brand, you know, if you're not on anything, then nobody is seeing you. So be on everything. But make sure the content is good, and then back it up with a really good product.
Have you worked out which 50% of advertising works?
I find that really difficult to work out. I'm sure that there's people much cleverer than me that can say, well, you've earned this from this and, you know, from this avenue. But no. But what we have seen is in our turnover, we have seen that grow year on year. So I think there's only been one year where we plateaued, but after that, it continued to grow. And that has been linked to social media. We did see a slightly more increased growth when we started to market consistently.
Yeah, consistency, I think, is absolutely key. How adventurous are you with flavorings? I mean, people, when they're with the craft beer industry started in South Africa, craft brewers were accused of trying to remake Castle Lager because it was the biggest selling beer. So people tried to emulate it. It kind of became a bit pointless. And I suppose in the chocolate world, well, you do a Turkish Delight and you do a nutty one and you do a strawberry one and an orange one and the usual flavors. How adventurous can you get? I'm not sort of thinking garlic and spinach flavored chocolate, but I mean, do you push the boat out and try new things?
Yeah, we do. Every chocolate shop has got to have those mainstays. Can't just go out on a limb with the extreme flavors. But yeah, we've combined things. We had a strawberry and a chili. We obviously have a chili. We've tried various other spice combinations, and if they have worked, we've kept them. If they haven't, we've removed them. But personally, I'm really adventurous. I'm just aware that I might be in a minority. So we tend to be very careful about what we do introduce, and we watch it very carefully. And if it's not popular, then we will remove it quite quickly.
What's been the best chocolate you've ever made that you loved that you had to discontinue because people just didn't get your superior sense of taste and style?
Actually, it's quite a mundane one. It's a lemon truffle. I like them. Lorraine loves them, and we've tried to introduce it on about three occasions, and it just fails completely. So it's that's the only one that has really been quite spectacular. Other ones, the strawberry and truffle, ultimately sort of it was successful and then sort of died a death. And over the years, it's you know, the combinations have been fruitful for a while and then have died, and we've just tried to replace them with something else. Some of them have stayed. Chili by itself is still quite popular. I did think of introducing a Marmite truffle once, but I don't know how that would be received. And the other one, I thought if I could, if I was concerned about shelf life, but I was thinking of soft cheese enrobed in dark chocolate. That was, I did try that at home. It was quite nice, but I was concerned about how long that would actually last on the shelf. So I.
I admire your courage. That's what I will say. I mean, I love Marmite. I love chocolate. I'm not sure about together. I love cheese. I love chocolate. I'm not so sure, but hey, you know what, Richard? You're the scientist. Will you become the scientist? Richard Tomes, lovely story. Thank you for sharing. The lead chocolatier at Chocolate by Tomes, ex-lawyer, ex-HR specialist, moved from the UK, start the chocolate business in South Africa. They sell between 50 and 60 tons of the stuff, expanding their factories. That'll be more jobs. And we export revenue too, because all of that chocolate is sold locally. Coming up in a moment, the Brutal Biz Quiz, as we like to do on a Friday. I hope you play, because it's fun. I'd like to play the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday. I'd like to know from you, please, the manufacturer of the following brands. They've got many, 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 many other brands. As we were talking about chocolate, this company makes Beacon chocolates. It makes Oros concentrate. It makes all gold jams and tomato sauce. It also makes Jungle Oats. What is the name of the company that makes all of those different delicious things? On 011-883-0702. 021-446-0567. Give us a call. Come and play on the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. Jungle Oats, All Gold, Beacon, Oros, and many, many, many other things are made by which company? Give us a shout.
The Money Show. With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA CIB, the sole sustainability coordinators of SAPI's recent 2 billion rand, 5-year sustainability-linked revolving credit facility. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Whew, lots of you want to play. Let's get to Mohammed in Melville first this evening. Mohammed, who makes Jungle Oats, All Gold Tomato Sauce, Beacon Chocolates and Oros?
Hi, Bruce. Tiger Brands.
Absolutely right, Tiger Brands. Good results. The recall of baby powder in December didn't really make a dent, and it's no longer an issue. Okay, here's something slightly trickier for you, Mohammed. Who makes Blue Ribbon Bread, Iwiza Maize Meal and Snowflake Flour?
Pioneer Food?
No, it doesn't, I'm afraid, Mohammed, but thank you for playing. Ndaba in Randburg. Oh, didn't even say hello. Oh, rude. He doesn't deserve an R. He didn't even bother. Christine in Stanford near Hermanus this evening. Hello, Christine.
I know. Sorry, I haven't got a clue. But I didn't have the Tiger Oats one. That was pretty obvious.
I like to be obvious in the beginning, Christine. They become slightly mysterious later on. You will know because you would have seen the silos all over the area where you are. But I'm afraid, yes. Ah, but thank you for staying and saying hello. Very nice of you. Primrose in Hammanskraal. Who makes Blue Ribbon Bread, Iwiza Maize Meal and Snowflake Flour?
Blue Ribbon Bread.
Yes, who makes it? Who bakes it? What's the company that bakes it?
Premier Foods.
Look at you. Look at you, Primrose. Absolutely right. The company, currently controlled by Brait, was due to list on the JSE, and in the last 48 hours, they've gone, are you mad? It's too scary and dangerous out there. Which engineering and construction company has sold its stake in Gautrain to Intertoll, which is an Amsterdam-headquartered infrastructure group? It's the company that built Gautrain.
Wow, pass. Bruce, your pass. I don't know that one.
I told you I'd become mysterious, Primrose, but thank you. Byron in Century City. Which company sold its Gautrain stake to Intertoll in Amsterdam?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'm going to have to bow out. Sorry.
How graceful. Last go, Deshaun. No, Deshaun, you can't play when you sound like that, I'm afraid. One last go for Deshaun. He capitulates. I'm the winner. You're the losers. I'm the winner. You're the losers. I could do this after Eyewitness News, but then we'd cramp the best bits. We don't like to cramp the best bits. Remember, it was a construction company called Murray and Roberts. Remember them? They used to be huge. Sadly, more in mining now than construction because there aren't the contracts available. But yeah, it had 50% in the Bombela Concession Company, the operators of Gautrain, and it sold that stake after since building the Gautrain, and it sold it to an Amsterdam-headquartered infrastructure company called Intertoll. That's interesting to me. It really is interesting because you're looking at foreigners coming in and buying assets in South Africa at a time where South Africans are frightened to buy assets. I'm curious about that particular trend. In a moment, we'll have Eyewitness News. And once Eyewitness News is done, we'll bring you some of the best bits from the week that has been here on The Money Show. Stand by for that.
702.
You're listening to the best of The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Welcome to the best bits of The Money Show. In an eventful week for South Africa, a digest of some of the best interviews from the show this week. If you do want to hear more, please go to our website, your favorite podcast app, and search for The Money Show. Listen, give us a rating, preferably a very, very good rating. Share it with your colleagues and friends, because there's absolutely no sense in being selfish about it. To start, some stories that have piqued our interest in the week's news cycle. With constitutional crisis thrust upon us on Thursday, late on Wednesday and into Thursday, as the Palapala report came out and found that there were questions that needed to be answered by the president. And, of course, we won't be playing any of the interviews around this tonight because it's just a moving target, really. The consequences of the blind stupidity of keeping cash on a farm in South Africa, regardless of how important and powerful you think you are. Blind stupidity. Really, it was. But too late to cry over spilled buffaloes on this particular thing. Let's look at some other stories that were in the news this week. Unemployment rate came down. Very few places in the world celebrate unemployment at 33%, but we did that this week because it was an improvement from the diabolical 34% in the second quarter. We also saw increasing reparations to South Africa for serious crimes committed at Eskom during the state capture area. A couple of companies have been paying their debts on that particular one. We also saw manufacturing activity begin to pick up for what it's worth. The APSA Purchasing Managers Index adjusted to 52.6, which is expansionary. Bit of good news. And then we shot ourselves in the foot with the Palapala catastrophe. Anyway, let's look at a couple of the other stories from the world of money from the week that has been. Slightly more cheerful end to the week than the Thursday and Friday evening editions of The Money Show. We'll start with an overview and an interview I had with Mike Sharman, the co-founder of the creative communications agency Retroviral. Mike was our guest on Other People's Money. He's been working with Nando's and Russell Hobbs and Dow Egberts and so many brands for a long time. He's also created Matchkit.co. He's authored two books, Brandalism and The Best Dick. He's got a stellar career, but is he any good with money? We'll find out in a moment. But first, it was also on Monday, coincidentally, his mother's last day of chemo. So Mike Sharman can't help himself. He turned it into an opportunity for a stunt.
Patience is a stretch, but when it's your last day of chemotherapy, we all need a little bit of cheer. And even for some of those people that were in the ward still, I thought that we should bring a little bit of festive vibe. So I had two Bear Bum waiters deliver some grape juice out of what looks like a champagne bottle, and then some branded cake to swoosh down the awesome opportunity and to celebrate the momentous occasion. So yes, always got to look for an opportunity to spread a bit of joy and entertainment. Bruce Whitfield, how are you, sir?
You know, incredible. I watched that stunt of yours today and I just chortled no end. Is your mum talking to you yet or not?
No, she was very apologetic, but the nurses were absolutely in pandemonium. They were loving it. They were a little bit short-staffed. I think there were nurses that were writing exams, so it definitely brought the right kind of flavor for a somber mood. And I was very polite about the starting process, and then it just kicked off, because I think we all need a bit of kindness, especially at this time of year.
Did you do it like a flash mob, or did you warn them that you were coming with men with no trousers?
Listen, Bruce, I have to tell you several times, the only F word we're not allowed to say at Retroviral is flash mob. That's a swear word. But it is very coordinated. You know, when you plugged in there to the intravenous setup, it takes several hours. So, you know, it was, we were there, we walked in calmly, spoke to some of the nurses and the receptionist, and I said, here we go, we're just bringing some festive cheer. And The boys went into the bathroom. They put on their aprons with their bottoms exposed and their bow ties. And they came out and, you know, I think it brought a lot of smiles to people's faces who were in quite a serious predicament.
So yeah, exactly.
It seemed to do the right kind of good for the day.
Yeah, and those Chemo Awards are places of great hope, of course, and maybe in some cases great despair. If the chemo has not had the desired effect, it's going to make you feel awful in the days afterwards, and hopefully it has a positive impact. And, I mean, the environment in which it is dispensed is not exactly the most cheerful place on earth either, so good to bring a little bit of cheer. Do you feel under constant pressure to make an impression, though?
I don't. I feel under constant pressure to entertain. I feel like it's in my bones. I love smiling, and I really dislike crying. Occasionally, it's good to get some tears out of your face. But generally, I think we as human beings, we are born to entertain. We are born to tell stories, and we are born to celebrate goodness. And I think that, you know, we have to listen to these terrible stories about basis points and genies coming out of baskets, basket cases, etc. So why not bring a little bit of cheer to everyone's life? And that's kind of what we try and do. We try and elevate opportunities from comedy and not necessarily lean into drama. Although I'm not averse to a bit of drama too, you know.
No, absolutely. I mean, when I look at your agency, and you've been around since 2010, which makes you a teenager next year. You combine, I think, three aspects of communication when you take to clients. You've got digital, which when you started in 2010 wasn't yet really a thing. It was kind of emerging as a thing. You do public relations and then activation, which is critical. Why are the three pillars of the way in which you deliver brand messages?
My view is that the more digital savvy we become, the more we crave human interaction. So you can't only engage and interact with human beings on a digital level. You have to have some kind of emotional connection, and that comes through physical experiences and immersing yourself in an opportunity to feel. Like, we all want to feel, and like I said earlier, sometimes that's humor, sometimes it's from crying, but we really realized over the last couple of years how much we missed other human beings. Like, I absolutely hate remote. I hate being out of your studio, not being able to sweat on you when we have a conversation, Bruce.
You know, there's some upsides to COVID, and that's one of them. Actually, I love it when you sweat on me, Mike. Now, when you look at the way in which you build campaigns, and Nando's has been very effective at this in terms of taking very serious themes and very serious material and making us laugh at ourselves in a way that we probably didn't think we could, on issues from Blue Light Brigades to Robert Mugabe and so many other things, where they actually take they show us how ridiculous the world around us sometimes is. And I think you play on that quite a lot.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, the most effective form of communication is where you can tap into an insight, a premise, or a truth that so many people across various lines of gender, background, demographics, creed, culture, religion exist. And self-deprecating form of humor is some of the best way for us to shine a mirror of our inadequacies or of our failings as a specific country or as leadership. And by putting that into the spotlight, I think we as South Africans do have one of the harshest yet most realistic sense of humors out there. Like, we can make fun of anything. And, you know, you've chatted a few times to my good friend Glenn Biederman Pam, and he talks about spoof being not talking down to anybody in particular, but it's bringing everyone into the humor, everyone into the laughter, and making fun of ourselves for the greater good, to just get us going through those load shedding stages from one to infinity. You know, that's the way that we cope with so many of our challenges.
Glenn Biederman Pam, of course, became incredibly famous. I'm sure he was famous before in many circles, but particularly famous with My Octopus Teacher spoof, My Creepy Teacher. And that was the collaboration that you two did, because you just saw this opportunity of this phenomenal documentary, which went on to win an Oscar, and said, which of our clients can we use just to have a bit of fun with this? And Creepy Crawly well for it. And they, I think they got enormous mileage from your nuttiness out of that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, occasionally we have to just try and give a crack at an idea and hope that it sticks. And, you know, I've consumed enough content over our teenage years of running Retroviral that I have a really strong gut feel. I believe that virality is a mixture of the science of preparing to to generate interest and talkability around remarkable content, but it's also that gut feel, like, is this thing going to work? And is this thing, does it have the potential to reach multiple eyeballs? And I think that's the one thing that we can really pride ourselves on our agency, is that we have a mixture of races, shapes and sizes and backgrounds, and quite unashamedly, I'll put ideas, or the team will put ideas into our work WhatsApp group, and there's absolute tree of trust. They can turn around and say, Mike, you sound like the old white guy. Nobody's going to get this idea. Let's can it before you get ahead of yourself. But when there is an idea that's entering the public domain, and now more than ever with streaming services, we operate in a realm where the global water cooler moment and the global zeitgeist exists, where we in South Africa are watching the same content as someone in South Korea in the United States. And that's what gives us an opportunity to really tap into ideas that have the potential to not only go nationally viral, but globally viral.
You were named as an individual recently in Provoke Media. They have an Innovator 25 list, which they publish every year. They've been doing it for several years now, I think. And they put you on a list of marketing and communications innovators, including Volodymyr Zelensky, who's been nothing but remarkable in communicating his country's plight to the world. But they said there's something weird going on in the water at the retroviral offices. And clearly there's Mike Sharman, chap drinks too much of that water.
You know, if you're not coming up with great ideas, you know, you're basically sitting still. And I think that that's ultimately what our job is to do. Like, we're going to take this country forward. We have to generate stimuli that's going to push the economy forward. It's going to help brands, businesses across the board really generate opportunities to drive bottom line returns. And I think that's what we like to pair creativity with business objectives. How can we take your product, your service, your offering, and add a layer of creativity to emotionally connect with an audience and actually drive upside for you? And I'm passionate about young entrepreneurs and inspiring young South Africans to start businesses. I think we need more and more support for SMEs. And if we can drive those opportunities, we can really do anything. Anything's possible, really.
I would agree. But how do you, though, measure your client's success? How do they measure the value they get? Because you can have a great campaign. Everybody can love the campaign. Does it translate to sales? Does it translate to money in the bank? Is really the only test that matters ultimately. Everyone can love it, but if they're not acting on the, if there's no call to action, or they're not acting on the call to action, then that was, you know, money created for entertainment rather than for generating business.
Well, that's exactly it, right? And even nowadays, I mean, when we started out, you couldn't buy media on Facebook. You couldn't buy YouTube pre-rolls. You couldn't essentially buy views and eyeballs. Nowadays, you can. You can pump enough money into any campaign and you can hit those 000s at the end and you can generate awareness. But for me, we are obsessed with awareness plus action, awareness plus conversion. So we always look at taking comms data and overlaying that with sales data. And most of the data with the companies and brands we work with are all being tracked in real time. So we have the opportunity to see, did X comms strategy impact bottom line sales? And that's where we measure ourselves on from a success point of view. So we are by no means a vanity metric agency. Our virality is awareness, eyeballs plus conversion.
How then do you manage your own life in amongst all of this creativity and this buzz of activity that happens within the agency? Because so often we get so busy doing what we're doing on a daily basis and have so much fun doing the job that we don't want to go and deal with the boring stuff like life's admin, which is unfortunately the tedious part of being an adult. Are you any good at the personal finance side of your life?
Adulting is terrible, but the best thing that I ever went through was a deal a few years ago where I was forced to scrutinize every bit of minutia around a financial perspective. And then that obviously carried into my personal life, where my wife and I are very transparent and very open about the communication in terms of what we want to achieve as older adults. Do we want to pay for our kids' weddings? Do we want to put them through university? Do we need to raise bucks to put them through private school? So we have a very open relationship in terms of discussing money and what we want to achieve. And we work very closely with our financial advisors, because like brands who come to us for communication support, I'm not a financial expert. I know the basics, but I need to work with a wingman, wingwoman to help me generate the best opportunities, the best strategies. And we look at all those opportunities. If we were to stay in Johannesburg for the rest of our lives, what kind of cash do we need to retire? If we were to emigrate to the Cape, if we wanted to move to a little island resort like Mauritius, like what do we need to achieve? And I think that's been the best opportunity over the last 4 or 5 years, is really to treat our personal finance like the books of our business. Because without granular understanding of margins and all the jargon and EBITDA and all those great and wonderful things, you have to run your personal life like a CEO, as you would your business, Bruce.
You used the plural for financial advisor. You said our financial advisors. Do you have separate financial advisors? Do you have many financial advisors together? Do you have like a team of people who come with briefcases and say it to you sternly as they clip open their briefcases? Explain.
Yeah, we have a team of two, a man and a woman. That's why I say wing man, wing woman. And they both have different skill sets, both from a strategic insight in terms of markets, and they both argue with my wife and I in terms of our own personal strategies and our investment portfolio opportunities. Like, my wife is anti-RA, whereas the one FA says, you know, well, you've got your RA, so you hedged against that bet. Let's put some bucks offshore, whilst the other one should keep some onshore while these tech stocks are crashing out and there's a massive bleed happening globally. So I think it's really important to have contrarian views, and then ultimately for you to do that additional research. Once you can obsess over aspects of finance that you can obsess like you would within your business, where it becomes really interesting. I mean, if you're obsessed with crypto and NFTs and, you know, blockchain, that's one thing. But how can you bring that consideration into your personal life? And where are you hedging the potential up and downsides if those situations start bullying or bearing, depending on what the situation is? So,
it feels like you picked up a personal finance section of the newspaper and read it this afternoon. That I must use bullying and bearing, and I must do this. I mean,
I've got a WhatsApp group with finance jargon, and every time I say something, one of my mates does a shot. So here we are. I think one of the guys is the OJ. I think a rumbler.
You're going to need to take them to ICU afterwards, I think. Now, the two people who bring you these strategic insights, are they independent? Do they work together? Are they competitors of each other?
Give it a plug. I've got a couple of FAs from PSG, and they've been great. And I think that ultimately we formed a relationship a few years ago. I spoke to a few different houses, a few different independents. I had a few relationships through friends and family, and ultimately we went shopping for the best kind of situation and solution, and people we felt were willing to challenge our headspace. And these two contrarian individuals, my wife is the pragmatic, grounded one, I'm the arty-farty one with his head in the clouds. So you almost need someone who's a little bit tough on you and who's going to push you to drive you to invest in your own considerations and your own thoughts for the future. It's not just about the investing in the money portfolio, it's investing in, like, what are the things that you want out of this? And I think too few of us, especially those of us in advertising, take the time to really understand what kind of goals, missions, attributes we want to get out, and how we're going to make our money work for ourselves. And I think so many people are terrified about finance. They'd rather stick their head in the sands. But yeah, if you can go and treat money like you would solving a brief for a client, I think it can take you very far in terms of where you want to achieve specific goals and how.
I think the important thing here, though, and what I'm hearing so strongly from you, is the amount of time that you were prepared to spend. You didn't sort of just go to, I like that brand of financial advice, or I like that particular investment house, I'm going to go there and buy stuff from them, or dad used this mob, so I'll just use them too. You went out very specifically and very intentionally to find people with whom you would gel, even in the subject of tough conversations.
Definitely. And, you know, like, I'm a fan of debate because I think it brings out the better upside and better returns for everybody. And I think if you don't have a partner in finance like that, and they're willing to just execute on a request, on a whim, I think that's a terrible thing. Like, I think you need to work with people that will push back, and they will question you on your logic and on your investment thesis, so that you can go back and you can say, listen, I've looked at this, I agree with you. It's the same thing in business. You know, if you're looking at taxation and you're looking at ways in which you would take potentially a dividend as opposed to a bonus, like, why would you do those things? And where are the potential pitfalls from a taxation point of view? Or where are the upside opportunities if you go down a different route? And I think ultimately, if you treat money like the thing that it is, it's a game, then ultimately you can win and you can lose. And I think that for me helps me in my headspace, especially as a as an advertising dude just to try and navigate this interesting world of money.
Now, the world of advertising, of course, you're tempted all the time by messages. Are you sufficiently cynical and being made cynical by your own industry not to fall for the hype of products and offerings? Or do you sometimes just go, I must have that thing that is on my screen right now that is being advertised to me. I don't care what it costs. The Small Indiana Skeletons question. Are you sometimes frivolous with money?
Not really. I mean, I'm like the least materialistic person. I'm also super tall, so I'm not built to fit into a supercar or like very expensive small race cars. So I think that that was definitely a genetic support
benefit
system.
Yeah.
But I'm not materialistic, so there's not a lot of stuff that I think I'll just buy on a whim. I'd rather like buy gifts for other people or like think about other people in my life as opposed to myself first and foremost. And, I'm super cynical about messaging. I think I'm constantly analyzing billboards, looking what people are saying. Also had some, like, really good chuckles recently with the guys from Naked and Pineapple laughing at their different messaging. And how fascinating, like, two ideas from two similar businesses in the same category, both going outdoor, when they never thought they would use anything other than digital. So I think, like, there's these moments in time where ideas just enter the ether, and then certain people are good at catching them and executing, and others let the opportunities go by. So, I'm super cynical about messaging, but at the same time, I'm very celebratory of stuff that I really like. I love tweeting about good advertising when I see it. And
so, I want a straight answer from you, Mike. When you're going to treat yourself or your wife or your kids, if you're going to treat your family, what is the most outrageous thing you would be prepared to spend money on?
So, my wife, definitely concert. Like, I would happily drop 10 grand for a ticket to a concert in another country. That became like a thing of ours, like go to New York and watch Bruno Mars in Madison Square Garden. So that's a splurge, travel and experiences off the back of travel.
You paid 10 grand to watch Bruno Mars?
For two tickets. Come on, Bruce.
You can like stream that stuff, close your eyes and imagine the concert, don't you?
No, it's not the same. I need Bruno Mars sweating on me, Bruce.
702. The best of the money show from this week.
Mike Charman, the co-founder at Retroviral, naughty man, talking about his relationship with money. Very considered. Our consumer ninja Wendy Nola looked at Black Friday debt discounts because this is a good idea. A lot of Black Friday discounts aren't really discounts at all, and they often encourage you to buy things that you don't really need. But if you could get a discount on your debt, would you be more prone to paying it off? Wendy Nola saying this is something that gets her stamp of approval. And that's rare.
Yes. So it was before I left and just before Black Friday. So Marco emailed me to say, I'm aware that monies are due, but I am nervous to make a settlement payment due to Woolies via a debt collector. So the debt collector had got hold of him to say, happy days. We're offering you an 80% Black Friday. They actually called it a Black Friday deal on your debt that you owe Woolies. So he says, I'm unsure that this is no more than a scam. From some of the complaints I've seen about this debt collector on Hello Peter, it appears that people have settled but not received settlement letter. How do I even know if they were actually acting on behalf of Woolworths? Well, to be fair, they had sent him a breakdown of the debt. I tweeted about this at the time, and a lot of people said, how do you owe Woolworths 124,000 Rand? How many roast chickens do you have to buy? Well, three quarters of that 124K was on a Woolworths credit card, so clearly not just Woolworths spend, and the other quarter was on a store card. The last payment that was made was 700 Rand, and that was in June of last year. So the settlement offer of 80% came to just under 25,000 Rand that would need to be paid. So, quite a massive luck there. The debt hadn't prescribed, importantly. It hadn't been dormant for 3 years. So he did still owe the money. Anyway, he asked me if I could just check with Woolworths, please, which I thought was quite sensible. I suppose he could have done it himself, but sometimes these things are easier for me as the non-customer. And yes, the Woolworths response was selected, and I think that's the key word, Bruce, selected customers have been offered settlement discounts of 80% by our external debt collectors. That particular debt collector has been mandated to make these offers to qualifying customers, and the offer is legitimate. Marco, when I went back to him with that news, said thank you very much, and then he told me he was asking for a friend. Who knows, but the facts remain that, yes, so 25,000 Rand is a lot easier to find and pay in a lump sum than 124K. That would have been, you know, gathering interest and fees for many more years to come, and would have, whoever debt that was, they would have been settled with it for a very long time. And interestingly, Bruce, I don't know of any others that have done it. I believe it's not all that unusual, and perhaps not the kind of thing that would genuinely find its way to my inbox. But a whole lot of people responded to tagging their credit providers on Twitter going, how about it? 80% off, please, please, please. But I do think if there's any discount worth taking up on Black Friday, it's settling your debt. I imagine those offers were made to people with massive debts who hadn't paid for a while and were probably unlikely to settle.
Are there any cautionary tales associated with this, Wendy? What do we need to keep an eye out for?
Because yes,
wherever there is a charitable solution to a problem, there is going to be, unfortunately, some shyster trying to take advantage of it.
Of course. And I think it could be argued that that offer would be considered by many as a too good to be true offer. And we're always saying if it's too good to be true, you know, stay away. So I'm glad Mark had checked. But a lot of debt collectors are chasing prescribed debt. So debt that is has been dormant for 3 years. They haven't made a payment. They haven't acknowledged it. They haven't been summoned in respect of it. So you don't want to be, you're not liable to pay it. And, you know, even 20% of a debt that you're not legally required to pay anymore is too much. So that's the first thing to check. I think that you might find a lot of these debt collectors who are chasing a prescribed debt might come with, and they do come, it's not normally 80%, but they'll come with, you know, 40% or something to entice people to pay. So that's the first thing to check. And I would always say go to the credit provider and just check that debt collector is legitimately collecting on their behalf, and check the amount owing and that sort of thing before you grab at a massive discount like 80% on your debt.
Now, a lot of people in a lot of families don't talk about debt. They don't talk about their financial problems. They don't disclose to each other that they've got themselves in shtuck. And you've got possibly the most innovative Christmas idea that I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think so too. I saw a press release around the same time that I was dealing with Marco's case. It was put out by Just Money. They put out a lot of informative articles and weekly newsletters aimed at making consumers more financially sussed. And it was mainly about budgeting for this festive season. And I thought this was practical, while rewarding yourself in some small way for surviving a tough year, because no one wants to just do 100% sensible things with, you know, at the end of the year. But, like, you know, budget and do it all right and everything in perspective. And it was a tiny little line, actually, with a link that caught my eye. And it was, have you considered paying off some of your loved ones' debts as a gift this year? Clearly, it's not an idea that retailers and banks will love. They want us to swipe the credit cards and spend, take up all the adverts and, you know, reward yourselves and all of that. But the reality is, I'm sure I said this recently on the show, of the 26.5 million credit active South Africans, roughly 62% are classified as being in good standing by the credit bureaus, which might sound quite good, but in good standing means not more than 3 months in arrears. So the number would be far lower, obviously, if you had to take into account those people who in the last 2 or 3 months had, you know, not met their repayments because, you know, increase in the interest rate and everything else. Anyway, so the article read, the amount of debt that you offer to your loved ones will depend entirely on your own financial situation and as much as you're comfortable gifting. If you get a bonus, I don't know who still gets bonuses, but if you do, you know, that's something you could do with it. you know, pay off the have a conversation, find out, you know, pay off the ones with the highest interest rate, or maybe for some people it would be the home loan and the or the car loan, where, you know, the a string of increases in the interest rates have, you know, are really hurting people. But the point of all of this, and while I think it's so wonderful, is that it kind of is a first step to discussing, and we're talking about really close people, loved ones, family members, close friends. It's the first step to actually being honest with each other about our financial situation and about how Christmas is a huge financial drain for so many of us. And you feel obligated, because if you love someone, you buy them a present. And that's what all the messaging and advertising sort of tells us. And I love this message for that reason, is to just maybe the time is now, this Christmas, Bruce, when things are so bleak for so many people, yeah, with so much financial pain from all angles, is start having that conversation. And just how good would it feel to say, okay, that store card debt, okay, it's 3,000 rand. How about I pay half of it instead of getting you a
air fryer,
item of clothing or perfume or something, or the air fryer. Yeah, I mean, I would love for families to start having these conversations and help and giving real help, real relief, because a nice goodie is fantastic and it's wonderful to open it and it's rah, 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 but not lying awake in bed at night with this huge burden, you know, and having the love of expressed as, let me help you out with your debt, rather than buying something new for you. I don't know about you, Bruce, but I just think that it's just lovely, and I hope that somebody listening thinks, actually, the time is now. Let's do this, and is brave enough to do it.
702. You're listening to The Money Show's Best Bits.
Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja. Our book featured this week, Impossible Bosses, Secret Strategies to Deal with 8 Archetypal Managers. Rob Craig is a co-author of this particular book, and shared with us some insights as to what it is that makes some managers more catastrophically awful than others.
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening, everyone at 702. What inspired me? Actually, there was one defining moment, Bruce. I remember a client of mine invited me to drinks, and it was an interesting moment where I thought I was going to land a huge deal. I was invited to a fancy hotel on the 30th floor where champagne is served. But 5 minutes later, the client was in tears because she was having the most horrific time. Why? Well, her boss was minimizing her, giving her no opportunity, taking all the credit for her work. And this sat with me quite a long while. And about 2 years ago, two of my other clients, who are now my also co-authors, Hanley and Vivian, they approached me, Bruce, and they said, Robert, we, Hanley and Vivian, have been working on many years of telling stories about the most interesting experiences. And they were coaching clients of mine. And when Hanley gave me a call, she said, Robert, I've been using a lot of your tips and techniques, and I want to use it in a book. So the three of us started speaking, and we were deeply moved by all the experience that we had. And why we wrote it was to help people feel a little bit more empowered, and to help people not feel helpless, certainly crying over a bottle of champagne. So,
if you're going to cry over something, it might as well be a bottle of champagne on the 30th floor, especially at the boss's expense. So many books are written about leadership. So many books are written about how to be a better leader, how to be a better boss, how to be a better manager, how to be. You're writing it from the opposite end and saying how to survive the bastards who haven't read the books on how to be better.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think there are too many books describing how people should be better. But where is the practical go-to coach in your pocket? Where is the chapter that I can pull out after I realize my boss is more difficult than I can manage? And I think there are many people listening tonight who go, yeah, there are a few moments that I don't know how to manage. And the biggest problem is, and I really think it's both good and a bad thing, the moment someone realizes the person they could have been, but then notice the person that they are, will be the greatest pain we all experience. And that tragedy can be prevented. And that's why we wrote the book.
It's a terrible indictment on 21st century management, I suppose, in the light of, I mean, I disclose now that I've had some pretty impossible bosses over time. I chose to go through the process and milk them for all they were worth, and at a point then move on. And I suspect that the vast majority of people's coping mechanism in an environment where the boss is toxic, where the boss is difficult, where the boss is actually impossible to deal with, is that they stay for as long as is good for them or until they can get another option, and then they just leave. The toxic boss is left behind. Why should we bother to stick around and manage the boss who is difficult?
Okay, so why stick around? I think there's two answers. I'll talk about the personal one first, and I'll talk about the company one second. The first thing is that I think we all recognize that the greatest lessons have always been married to the toughest challenges. Life doesn't give us the best lessons with a cherry. It gives us the ones with the hardest dig and the hardest challenge and the hardest mountain. So when you have gone through an enormously difficult challenge, to leave when it could have given birth to your greatest growth kind of seems a bit silly to me, I think. Mm. And now for the corporate answer, a lot of great companies have a cultural problem. So the book does two things. It helps the individual, but it also helps the leader who might be worried they could become or are behaving like an impossible boss, and what to do to rebalance themselves. So corporates should take this a little more seriously, because perhaps culture is like a cloud. You can see it, you can feel it, but if you try and change culture, it's really, really difficult. So the three of us got together really trying to enable the individual and the company who want to take culture a little more seriously. So we really think high-pressured, successful humans do have a responsibility to not become an impossible boss too.
So there is no question, Robert. Sorry to interrupt. But, I mean, what is the difference between a high-level demanding boss, somebody who demands the best of their teams, somebody who doesn't take half measures as an excuse, somebody who is performance-driven and an impossible boss? Because for many people, that would be them just being difficult and an impossible boss and being unreasonable. And, you know, sometimes really high-level demanding people are brilliant bosses who draw the best out of their out of their staff. And those, I think, are rare, but not impossible to find.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the difference? Sure. Okay, that was the crux of our challenge, because it's a fine line, it's a gray area, and it's difficult to catch. It's a bit like a slippery bar of soap. In our opinion, the three of us realized one important fact. It's what's the cocktail inside the human you're thinking of. And so we realize there's quite a difficult challenge in front of us to discover the cocktail. And what I mean by that is there are high-performing bosses, like you began your question with, who are incredible. And they're demanding. They have high standards. They won't settle for anything second. But the minute they become impossible is possibly because of one of the ingredients being something maladaptive. In other words, it's not particularly healthy. It's a little bit toxic. And those sorts of things are the insecurities that we come with. Let me give an example I think might help the listeners understand. In the book, there's a character called Miss Say Me. So as the word implies, Say Me is all about me, me, me. But the cocktail that explains what turns this person from a great boss into somebody impossible is that their determination is more aggressive than anything else. It's not quite in control. Two, their mind, their brain, makes regular comparisons. Now, you can't be competitive if your brain doesn't make comparisons. We need comparisons. So in this cocktail is a person who makes regular comparisons, likes to win, but adds a little bit of aggression every time it's mixed.
702. The best of the Money Show from this week.
Rob Craig, the co-author of Impossible Bosses on The Money Show on Monday. Well, after working for 20 years for JSE-listed companies and private businesses doing corporate communications, PR and marketing, Kerry Rudolph had a change of life. She has decided to create her own business. She founded the IV Bar Group. And with very little of her own money up front, she's created a franchise operation so far with 20 outlets. And it's growing. I got my arm pricked on your behalf so that I could feel what it was like to get a flood of vitamins induced into my system. It was interesting. Have a listen to Kerry Rudolph as we talk about how she funded the business. And then, of course, she bragged about the benefits I was going to feel from all of those vitamins.
So how's it, Bruce? So divine to have you here. And you see, you were a little anxious about what it would feel like.
I was not anxious. I'm a very brave and tough individual.
It's very gentle. This is what our nurses do all day, and they are brilliant professional nurses, so it will not hurt. Right, so as you rightly said, I come from a investor relations, PR, marketing background, and a few years ago I got divorced and decided to have a little bit more flexibility for my kids, so got out of corporate and started my own business. So I used to drip with my doctor. I loved the benefits of it. It made me feel amazing, but I didn't like the experience. It would take you a week to get an appointment. You'd sit at the back of a doctor's room. Nurses struggled to find your veins. Drip would take you 2 hours. So the whole process was quite unpleasant. So my idea was to rather put it into an environment which looked amazing, where your experience would match the benefits.
No, but the environment feels, again, I don't like to show off, but I do spend time at the slow lounge sometimes. It feels a bit slow loungy.
That's exactly right. So is that worrying you?
No, not at all. I'm sitting here with Kerry. There are two nurses who, if this was in America, if I was in America, I'd be worried that this was going to be my final moment. But we are getting injections put into I'm assuming it's a saline drip.
That's right.
And these are injections of vitamins and potions, and there's been a yellow one. This is a red one.
Okay.
Oh, so, my goodness gracious. We'll get to the detail in a moment.
Okay, then we'll tell you exactly what
to do. Go back to origination, Kerry. Right. Don't be distracted.
So I decided to start something where the environment would look great. I loved a slow lounge environment. I loved a Starbucks environment. So for me, I created a lounge where it literally felt like Starbucks meets slow lounge. So you spot on. We wanted people to feel very relaxed when they walk in. It's a tranquil spot. You can have a cappuccino. We often have someone doing a foot massage at the same time. So while we take the retail side of it very carefully and very seriously, the medical side is obviously it's so important. So
but you're not a doctor. You're not a registered medical person by any stretch. So there seems to be a disconnect there.
Yes. So I am not a doctor. And our franchisees don't need to be doctors, which is the beauty of it.
It looks like urine now. Sorry. It looks like I'm being filled with pee. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
That's your banana drip. That's your Myers cocktail, which originated in the 1960s, by the way, just in case you think it's a new thing. So we'll tell you about that. So we've got a chief medical officer, and we've got a couple of doctors that are on our medical board. So they actually consult to us. We then outsource everything to a company called Fagron. They do all our vitamins and minerals at the perfect dosage that it needs to be. That's completely safe. And then we've obviously got our registered nurses who have all worked in hospitals. I can taste it straight away. You'll see if you can actually taste it. People often say, can you taste it or can you smell it? I find you can both it. You can taste and smell. That's the bees that goes in. So
I can smell vitamin B, definitely. Yes.
Yeah, that's the bees that's going in. Exactly. Is it flowing nicely? Okay, so my whole idea was, yes, to create that lounge environment that really would give people that peace of mind when they're going into it.
The best of The Money Show.
Live, online.
Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and DStv Channel 856.
92.7 and 106 FM.
Thank you, Kerry Rudolph, the founder and chief executive of Ivy Bar. Well, that's it from the Best Bits of the Money Show. A digest of some of the best interviews from the show this week. Not everything. Couldn't do everything because with the moving target of Palapala and the consequences and the fallout and all of that sort of drama, we leave that to the blow-by-blow radio stuff. If you do want to hear more, go to our website, your favorite podcast app, and search for The Money Show. Anyway, thank you for listening. Back on The Money Show, 6 p.m. on Monday, if there's any money left to talk about. Till then, have a good weekend. Good night.